reach. So I failed to set boundaries, and I failed to take care of myself. During Cleo's first overnight visit with us, we were walking down the street toward the party the three of us were attending together. I wasn't prepared when he put his arm around her, and I felt my throat constrict and the ground drop out from under me. I wasn't prepared when, surrounded by people in a packed room that allowed very little movement, I got separated from them and watched from across the room while they sat together and flirted, and I felt the walls closing in. And I wasn't prepared to lie awake the entire night while he spent the night with her in the guest room, or for my emotional meltdown the next day. There were some basic things Peter and Cleo could have given me that would have helped me ease into the situation and feel safe. We talk about those in Chapter 9. But I didn't know to ask for them. In fact, I actively avoided asking for them, because I wanted to be the strong, noble Polly person who never felt jealous or insecure. I was looking at where I wanted to be standing, instead of where I was standing, and what I wanted to offer, instead of what I actually could at the time.
As Eve's story illustrates, none of us are perfect. Our lives are filled with struggles and mistakes. The effort to be perfect only drives us away from one another and damages our self-worth. The reason you need to understand where you are right now is so that you can understand your limitations. Your relationships will benefit if you can examine what your triggers are, not so that you can instruct everyone to tiptoe around them, but so you can be aware, when you're triggered, of what is going on. Knowing where you stand now will help you remember that there's not something wrong with you when you feel jealous, when the ground drops out from beneath your feet, when you see your husband holding hands with his girlfriend for the first time. You can't control how your partner's other relationships will develop, but you can control how you allow them to intersect with and affect your life. You are allowed to set boundaries on your personal space and time. You don't have to make the first time you hang out with your husband and his girlfriend be a public appearance at a crowded party. You don't have to be okay with hearing them have sex, now or ever. Take care of yourself so you can take care of those around you. When you make mistakes, think in the terms of, I'm a person who values integrity, rather than, I am a super-together person. Think of compassion and free will as values you strive for, not attributes you have. That way, you can more easily realign your actions with your values if things go wrong. For example, if you think of yourself as a person who values free will, you can respond constructively when someone points out that you appear to be trying to control someone. Minding the gap is about being able to see these things. Very few of us make it to adulthood without getting a little broken on the way. None of us can see each other's wounds. None of us really know what the other person's struggles look like from the inside. But one thing's for sure, we all have them. Polyamory can push on our broken bits in ways that few other things do. We may be able to build walls around deep-rooted fears, insecurities, and triggers in monogamous relationships, walls that poly relationships will often raise to the ground. And because so many more people are involved, more people stand to suffer. We all have things we need to work on. Expected. Worthiness. Polyamory will challenge your emotional resiliency. Instead of building walls around painful feelings like fear and jealousy, you'll need to find a way through them. You may experience more loss. More relationships mean more possibilities for heartbreak. And you may encounter judgment, slut-shaming, trivialization of your relationships, and claims that you're treating your partners badly or neglecting your kids are some of the most common forms. We discuss these more in Chapter 25. But what's important here is developing a sense of self-worth that protects you from the internalization of these corrosive messages. You'll sometimes hear poly people say things like, don't give other people power to hurt you. But that ignores the very healthy impulse to seek feedback on our perceptions of the world. Even the healthiest person, when persistently rejected, will be hurt. Rejection may erode your mental boundaries or your ability to engage in intimacy. The only way to maintain good mental boundaries, to counteract social rejection, and to assess when to disengage is to have self-knowledge and self-confidence, and to engage in self-compassion and self-care. In other words, to commit to behaviors that will help you develop a strong sense of worthiness. And yes, feeling worthy is a practice too. Here is Eve's story.
The first time in my adult life I remember feeling worthy was when I was 36 years old. It started with a conversation I had with my poly women's group. We were talking about worthiness and how it connects to our sense of belonging, which we get when we allow ourselves to be vulnerable and are accepted as we are. But being able to allow that vulnerability requires, gotcha, a sense of worthiness. To connect with others, we must take a leap of faith and believe we are worthy of connection. Inside, I was growing more and more distraught. I don't know how to feel worthy. Finally, I asked, how do we begin to believe we are worthy? My group member said, well, maybe imagine what it feels like to feel worthy and focus on that. Over time, it will begin to feel real. I took a deep breath and made a very scary and vulnerable admission. I don't know what it feels like to feel worthy. I was surprised at how much it hurt to say those words, to admit that the concept of worthiness was so far outside my realm of personal experience that I couldn't even imagine it. Unfortunately, because I'm not entirely sure how I learned how to imagine worthiness, I find it difficult to advise others. I know that I worked at it. I read, I blogged, I took risks with my friends by sharing more with them. I started keeping a daily journal of things I was grateful for. I had recently completed several months of intense therapy, and the work I had done there seemed to finally start to take hold. But the truth is, I don't know what the pivot was. One day, I just felt worthy. Since feeling worthy does not come naturally to me, if I do not work at reminding myself, the feeling fades, and then I slip back into a miasma of fear and self-doubt. Then I remember to start practicing again, and I work my way back out.
The good news is that once you know what worthiness feels like, only once, you know that you can experience it, even if you aren't experiencing it right now. A sense of worth is critical to counteracting the scarcity model of love and life. If we do not believe in our worth, we become disempowered, unable to advocate for our needs. We do not see or embrace the love that is actually around us in our lives. It becomes harder to treat our partners well because we do not see what we bring to their lives. And if we don't understand our value to them, we are more likely to feed our jealousy and fear of loss. Notice that institutions built on the scarcity model, too many workplaces, too many families, always inculcate a sense of low self-worth. Worthiness is not the same as validation. A sense of self-worth comes from within, not from someone else. It can be tempting to look to the outside for validation, to look to your partner and say, "She loves me, therefore I am worthy." That creates fear rather than reducing fear, because when we rely on outside things in order to feel worthy, we fear losing them all the more. In the end, we can't wait until we see evidence that we are worthy before we allow ourselves to believe it. We start by taking that leap of faith and believing we are worthy. A sense of self-what, psychologists might term self-differentiation, has a huge impact on relationships. If we make mistakes that hurt people, we can say, "I did something bad," rather than "I am bad." And if something is our fault, that means it is within our power to change the outcome. Low self-worth will try to protect itself, sometimes in sneaky ways. It can tell us that if we have a high sense of self-worth, we might not get our partner's time and attention because we're not in a crisis. Emotional crisis can become a way to get our partners to give us what we need. The solution to this problem is tricky. Well, one place to start is to look at the people who do have a strong sense of self-worth and see if their needs are being met. If you are struggling with worthiness, you will find resources at the back of the paperback and digital edition of this book. If you are seriously struggling, professional help can be a huge benefit, not just in your intimate relationships, but in all parts of your life. Self-efficacy. Let's say you, as our intrepid mushroom hunter, get lost in the woods. Do you know a few wild plants you could collect to feed yourself? Do you know how to find water? How to make a shelter and stay warm? If not, how confident are you in your ability to figure these things out? Will you begin to panic? Will you think, "Oh my God, I'm going to die. I don't know how to survive in the forest." Or will you take a deep breath and say, "Well, I've never done this before, but here I am, and I'd better get on with it. Let's see, it's getting dark. I guess the first thing is to look for some shelter and figure out if there's something I can eat. There's a kind of calm that comes from believing you can handle a situation, even one you haven't faced before, and that calm increases your competence. This effect is called self-efficacy. Trying new things, like writing a book or exploring polyamory, involves learning new skills, and research shows that the key to learning new skills is simply believing you can learn them. Self-efficacy in poly relationships is the feeling that you can make it through your wife's first date, that you'll figure out a way to manage your jealousy, even if you don't know how yet, that if you have to sleep alone some night, even if it's been years and you don't remember what it feels like, you'll get through it and be okay. All this may seem to have a flavor of New Age, power of intention pop psychology, but the study of self-efficacy goes back 4 decades, and there's solid evidence supporting it. Whether or not someone believes they can do something has important effects on whether they can. This is proven true from everything from learning skills to quitting smoking. As to developing this calming competence, research has identified strategies for improving self-efficacy. Here are 2 simple ones. Small successes. Step outside your comfort zone. Find something you can succeed at, something that seems hard to you, but not so hard that will land you quivering under the covers in tears. Stay home while your wife is on a date. Talk to your partner about your insecurity or jealousy. Each small step will build on the last, giving you a stronger sense of your ability to tackle the next challenge. They won't necessarily become easier, but the key is to develop your belief that I can do this. The flip side of that is to address how you cope with failure. If it turns out you weren't quite as strong yet as you'd hoped, people with high self-efficacy tend to be resilient in the face of failure. They know that often you have to fail many times before you succeed. Role models. An important factor contributing to a person's idea of whether they can do something is whether they see other people doing it. We can't stress enough the usefulness of having polyamorous role models. Ideally, people in your social network who you can talk to and get feedback from. Find your local poly discussion and support group, or start one. As polyamorous people, we are surrounded by a culture that tells us, you can't do this, that's not possible, or even, that's morally wrong. It can be hard to maintain a belief in yourself and your abilities in the face of this social censure, especially when things get hard. That's why it's critical to establish a poly-friendly support system and find people you consider to be good examples. We discuss this more in Chapter 25 on social and community support. Building self-efficacy in other areas of your life also builds success in poly relationships. It takes the bite out of 2 scary monsters, failure and being alone. For many of us, for example, our first breakup is the scariest because it's our first taste of romantic failure. Will we find love again? What if the person we just broke up with was the one? Believing that you can be alone and thrive, that you can survive the end of something and rebuild, are important elements of self-efficacy. A special kind of commitment. An essential aspect of successful poly relationships, in our experience, is a commitment to being poly. Sometimes learning the skills is hard. We have to practice and muddle through painful situations when they befall us. At some point, poly may just feel too damn hard. Here's Eve's story.
Despite all our preparation, Peter and I didn't really know what to expect when Ray and I became lovers. I got caught up in a full-on flood of new relationship energy, and Peter, with whom I had settled into a low-key, 8-year relationship groove, struggled with the intensity of it all. One day, when Ray and I had been lovers for about a month, Peter sat me down and said, "You're falling in love with Ray." He was right. Surprisingly, perhaps, we had never talked before about the possibility of falling in love. And there we were, and we weren't ready. My growing relationship with Ray forced me and Peter to confront a long-buried structural problem in our relationship, one we'd been able to sweep under the rug for years. One day, the day before I was scheduled to go visit Ray, Peter told me he wasn't sure he wanted to be with me anymore. I panicked. I said I wanted to cancel my trip so I could stay home and work on things with Peter, but Peter said no. He wanted me to go. And he wanted me to stay with Ray until he had decided he was ready for me to come back. I drove the next day to see Ray, and that afternoon we made love. And then I lay there sobbing in his arms, torn apart by conflicting emotions. Fear and grief at the thought of losing Peter, joy at the new connection with Ray. And then, suddenly, I accepted the situation. I imagined myself without Peter, was able to picture my life without him, and I realized that even without him or Ray, even alone, I would be okay. I wrote in my journal that day, "After a few days of feeling in free fall, it's like I suddenly looked behind me and realized, oh, I have wings." A couple of days later, Peter called and said it was okay for me to come home. The ground beneath our relationship had shifted dramatically, as it would continue to over the next few years, as we found our new normal. But coming face to face with the reality of losing Peter inoculated me against some of the fear that accompanies the biggest changes and greatest uncertainties. Having looked the worst-case scenario in the eye, I found it no longer scary.
Eve has called this kind of time the dark night of the soul moment. Unless you are truly exceptional, you will experience it at some point, usually early on. Maybe your partners are struggling. Maybe you're tired of fighting with your inner demons. And this is when it really matters whether you've committed with all your heart and soul to being poly. If you don't commit, if you aren't ready for that dark night of the soul, and you back away in fear when it comes, then you and the people you love are going to get very hurt. So be ready, because if you step into it and keep walking, you will get through it. It ends. Know that you're not alone. Thousands of people before you have walked this path. Not exactly yours, of course, but just as dark and scary. It ends, and it gets better on the other side. Getting through that dark night removes its power over you, and that's what it takes to get you and your partners and their partners onto a solid footing that will lead you to happiness, a place where you can make clear-headed decisions focused on the good of everyone. The longer people avoid confronting that dark night of the soul, the more power it has over them and their relationships. Some people elaborately construct their entire lives to avoid confronting fear. Many people use the hearts of their lovers or metamors as sacrifices to the unknown beasts they think live within the darkness they're not willing to explore. We urge you, if you're going to explore polyamory, don't just dip a toe in. One, that's not going to give you the strength and tools to succeed. Two, you'll be treating people as things. Of the people who decide to make that commitment, to live polyamorously and treat their partners ethically, even when it means confronting those heart-shaking fears, no one makes quite the same trip. Everyone charts a different path through that dark night, but it begins with commitment, knowing you are going to do this and that you can. Courage. When many of us think of courage, we think of heroics, of facing down a tank in Tiananmen Square. But every day, ordinary courage is the courage it takes to confess a crush, the courage it takes to say, yes, I'm going to open my heart to this person, even though I don't know what the outcome will be. The courage to love a partner who loves another person, even though you do not have the trappings of security that monogamy promises. The courage to sleep alone. The courage to begin a relationship with someone who's already partnered, trusting that person to carve out the space for you that you're going to need. This kind of moral courage comes from a willingness to be vulnerable and to accept that you will be okay even if you don't know what will happen. And you know what? Courage is required, because sometimes what we're trying doesn't work. The tank rolls over us. Our vulnerability is rejected, or worse, mocked. That's the whole thing about courage. It can't promise a happy outcome. We can't say, be brave and vulnerable, and you will obtain love and master happy poly relationships ever after. It wouldn't be courage if there were any guarantees. You may feel like saying, well, I'm just not that brave. But we're not talking about something you are or are not. We all have times when we act with courage and times when we don't. In fact, it's something that we and our partners struggle with all the time. Like everything else we talk about, courage is not a destination. Courage is a verb. Grammarians be damned. It's not something you have, it's something you do. You practice a bit every day. And if you fall down, if your courage fails you, You always get another chance. Always. Courage happens in increments. You'll need courage because polyamorous relationships can be scary. Loving other people without a script is scary. Allowing the people you love to make their own choices without controlling them is scary. The kind of courage we're talking about involves being willing to let go of guarantees and love and trust your partners anyway. So how do you learn to have courage, to develop this practice? Imagine you want to learn how to swim. You sign up for swim lessons. You get yourself a swimsuit and goggles. And on the day of your lessons are to begin, you show up at the pool, nervous and eager. Imagine if, to your surprise, the swim coach takes you out on a boat. What, maybe you'll learn to swim off the side of a boat? But instead, he spends the entire day teaching the basics of sailing, how to tie knots, how to tack against the wind, how to work the sails. When you've mastered the art of sailing, the swim coach intones, you will know how to swim. You would know that's daft. Yet often that's exactly how we try to learn skills like trust and courage. We try to build the skills that can help us face our fears by doing the things that are completely unrelated to courage. Things like avoiding the triggers for our fears or creating structures that shelter us from things we're afraid of. Waiting until we feel brave. If we fear that a partner might want to leave us, we lay down regulations telling her not to. If we fear being replaced by someone sexier than we are tempted to create prohibitions that restrict certain kinds of sex. We do not learn courage or trust by avoiding the things that trigger our fears, any more than we learn to swim by trimming the sails on a boat. In fact, the time and effort we spend doing this is time and effort we are not spending learning to swim. As you well know, you learn to swim by getting in the water. Maybe you start with kicks at the shallow end of the pool, but you need to get wet. We learn courage by taking a deep breath, steadying ourselves, and then choosing the difficult, scary path over the easy way out. As the theologian, Mary Daly, says, we learn courage by couraging. The path of greatest courage also seems like the hardest. It takes us right past the places where our fear lives. But just as we cannot put off learning to swim until the day we magically know the butterfly stroke, we cannot put off learning courage until the day we magically become courageous. This is work we must do, now, to create fertile ground within our relationships that allows us to move with integrity and compassion. Questions to ask yourself. To become more self-aware and identify your personal strengths, weaknesses, and fears, especially as they relate to relationships, here are some questions to consider. Why do I have romantic relationships? What do I get out of them? What do I consider essential, indispensable elements of a relationship? Are there specific kinds of relationships that I know I'm looking for, kinds that I know I don't want? What do I bring to the table for others? What makes me feel cherished, loved, and secure? What makes me afraid in relationships? Why? In what ways do I protect myself from being hurt? Do those strategies help or hinder my search for connection? 5. Nurturing your relationships. Everyone who tries to create love with an emotionally unaware partner suffers. Bell Hooks. When you start down the path of polyamory, your relationships may grow in all kinds of different directions. Shaking off the template of monogamy means you're free to build your life to your specifications, consistent with compassionate treatment of the people close to you. We can't tell you what your life will look like. We can tell you one thing, though, particularly if there are two of you starting from an existing relationship. It will change. Quite likely, it will change in ways you don't expect. If there are weaknesses in your existing relationship, polyamory has a way of finding them. Trying to buffer these changes with rules probably won't work very well, for reasons we talk about in Chapter 10. The things you think will be important might not be, and things you don't think about at all might be the ones that challenge you. We've spoken to countless couples who have come to polyamory, and the one thing we've heard over and over is, when we talked about this, the things we thought would be most important weren't, and things we hadn't thought about were. The first part of laying the groundwork for polyamory concerns yourself, things like developing security, self-confidence, and flexibility. The second involves creating fertile soil for growth in your existing relationship, if you have one. The tools for doing these two different things will be very similar. Those of you who are currently single or solo poly don't necessarily get to skip over this chapter, because past relationship experience and the assumptions we carry with us can still surprise us in unexpected and unpleasant ways. The issue of security. Why do we seek romantic relationships? For many of us, relationships are a way to feel loved and treasured and to share some part of our life with people who support and nurture us. When we found a relationship or two, we want to feel safe there, to feel like we can relax into the security of our partner's love. In poly relationships, the need for security tends to play out in two ways. First, we can be tempted to seek security by placing controls on our partners. Whether it's limiting a partner's access to other people to build our sense of security against being replaced, or restricting our partner's range of action with others to make ourselves feel safe. We can be lured by a feeling that if we can just get our partners to do what we want, we will feel secure. Conversely, if we are at all compassionate, we want to help our partners feel safe. So we might be tempted to accept their restrictions in the hopes that we can make our partners feel more secure. Security is a tricky thing. On the one hand, our choices do affect our partner's security a lot. On the other, genuine security has to be built from within. Security that rests on another person's actions is fragile and easily lost. Four principles about security seem to be true. It's impossible to make another person be secure. We can provide a compassionate and supportive environment by providing reassurance, by listening, by acting in thoughtful ways. But these actions cannot make someone else secure. Internal work is required for a sense of security and confidence. It's almost impossible to build a strong relationship of any kind amid insecurity. This seems especially true in polyamory. Insecurity invents its own evidence and supports its own premises. No amount of someone else's time and effort is enough to make an insecure person see the light and realize that the insecurity is unfounded. He or she must intentionally and deliberately challenge, understand, and then choose to move past the insecurity. Intentionally and deliberately challenging, understanding, and choosing to move past insecurity is frightening, uncomfortable work. Staring our inner demons in the face is so uncomfortable that it can make crawling through broken glass dipped in alcohol and rattlesnake venom seem like a cakewalk. It is the rare person who's willing to do this without being prodded into it. And this principle has a corollary. Trying to avoid upsetting a partner by giving in to their insecurity or steering around their sensitivities and triggers can become enabling, reinforcing rather than alleviating the problem. The very things we do to try and make a partner feel more secure can make the insecurity worse. Another point we've learned. As counterintuitive as it may seem, sometimes a lasting sense of security comes more from knowing a partner is free to go but chooses to stay than from attempting to obligate that partner to stay. Practicing security. Insecurity is toxic. You can't trust what you're always afraid of losing. You can never become a full partner in a relationship you do not believe you deserve. You can never embrace happiness if you do not believe you are good enough for it. When we feel insecure, it can blind us to the love our partners offer, which makes us feel alienated, which makes us more insecure, which blinds us to the love we're offered. Here is Eve's story.
I have always been pretty profoundly insecure. Not long ago, I had an epiphany. It's as though I imagined that each person casts a circle of light around them. That light is their affection. People bring you closer in, into brighter light, depending on how much they like you. In all my relationships, personal and professional, romantic or friendship, I have always felt I was standing just outside that circle of light, always hesitant to take a step forward, always petitioning for entry, and always a bit sheepish about that petitioning, never sure I would be welcome. Even in my closest relationships, I never pictured myself included in the circle, so I could never simply feel calm and confident that the relationship existed and would continue. To say it another way, I always felt I was the one asking, never the one offering, as though time spent with people I cared about was something I took from them, not something I gave to them. This perception caused the end of at least a couple of my relationships because it caused me to pull away, to stop investing. I felt that investing in relationships with the people I cared about was a burden on them. I had a close friend in university who, for about a year, I spent most of my social time with. One weekend, we spent 3 days backpacking together in the Olympic Mountains. I remember sitting by the fire with him, feeling insecure, of course, worried that I might be getting on his nerves. The thought crossed my mind, I hope he doesn't hate me. Then the absurdity of the thought struck me. If he hates you, why would he be spending 3 days in the mountains with you? But it took another, decade and a half for this kind of realization to become normal. When I had the epiphany about the circles of light, I realized that in most of my relationships, I had been standing in the light all along. All it took for me to be inside it was to realize that I already was. I found that simply imagining that circle, and that it contained me, changed my interactions with the people close to me. That visualization is now an ongoing practice.
Franklin has talked to many people who say things like, I'm just an insecure person. As if feeling insecure is something they're born with. In reality, it is something you can control. Insecure is something you can, if you want to, choose not to be. We are big believers in the affirmative power of choice, and we believe that people are often insecure because they make choices dozens of times a day that confirm and reinforce their own insecurity. Changing the way you feel about yourself is painful and uncomfortable. For that reason, many people choose, without necessarily even being aware that it is a choice, to hang on to destructive ideas about themselves rather than face the discomfort and fear of changing those ideas. Self-image, like playing the piano, is something you become good at by practice. If you practice being insecure, if you accept thoughts and ideas that tear down your sense of self, if you lie in bed at night and think about the reasons you are not worthy or good enough, then you become highly skilled at being insecure. On the other hand, if you practice security, if you reject thoughts and ideas that tear down your sense of self and accept ideas that build it up, if you lie in bed at night and think about the qualities that make you special and give the people in your life value, then you become skilled at being self-confident and secure. On his website, Franklin's Guide to Becoming a Secure Person is one of the most popular essays he's ever written. Here's a 3-step exercise that he has found incredibly valuable for building internal security. Step 1. Understand that you have a choice. You did not choose your past experiences, of course. The people who made fun of you in fifth grade, or a past partner who told you weren't good enough. But right now you have a choice about continuing to believe them, or changing the things you believe about yourself. The single hardest thing to do to change your self-image is to realize that you have the choice. The rest gets easier. Step 2. Act like someone who is self-confident. Even if you aren't, fake it till you make it. It's a great personal development strategy. You might not control your feelings, but you do control your actions. You control your body. You can choose to act self-confident, even if you don't feel it. When faced with something that scares you or makes you feel threatened, think what choice you'd make if you were confident and secure, and then do that. Even if it scares the hell out of you, no one will know. Do you feel insecure when you see your partner kiss his other partner in front of you? Take a deep breath and say, I feel insecure when I see this, but I want you to do it anyway. And let it happen. Acting self-confident will feel phony and forced at first, but gradually it will become normal. Step 3. Practice. You become good at what you practice. A person who is insecure becomes very good at being insecure because he practices all the time. You practice being insecure by thinking about those old insults you heard in fifth grade and telling yourself they are true. You practice being insecure by going over in your mind all the reasons you are not good enough to be with your partner. People who are secure practice being secure. Stop thinking about those old insults. When they come to mind, tell yourself, no, these are false, and I choose not to believe them anymore. When you find yourself thinking about all the things that are wrong with you, stop and say, no, these are wrong. Here's a list of things that are good and sexy about me instead. Corny as it sounds, writing a list of things you like about yourself and keeping it in your pocket helps. When you find yourself thinking about why your partner doesn't or shouldn't really want you, stop yourself and say, no, this is not true. Practicing security means continually turning toward the best version of yourself. Each belief about yourself that you choose to hold on to in each moment is a step toward or away from the person you want to be. As Canadian entrepreneur Lynn Robinson says, our beliefs about ourselves are all made up, so it's a good idea to make up some good ones. Fear of loss. We love our partners, hopefully. We are with our partners because they bring us joy. And allowing that joy inside makes us vulnerable, because life is uncertain. With joy comes the fear of losing the thing that makes us joyful. For many of us, the kind of vulnerability that comes with letting in deep, heartfelt joy is a little scary. For some of us, it's terrifying. Some of us protect ourselves from that fear by never allowing ourselves to fully open up, or numbing ourselves by imagining worst-case scenarios. Others of us protect ourselves by trying to control the people around us, to keep the possibility of loss at bay. Our distress may be compounded by the cultural script that says if you aren't torn apart by the thought of losing a partner, it means you don't really love them. In reality, commitment and fear of loss are only indirectly related. Often the fear of loss is more closely linked to a fear of being alone than commitment to a partner. In monogamous relationships, losing a partner means being alone. And paradoxically, if you want something too badly, the fear of losing it can become greater than the joy of having it. When that happens, we hold on to things not because they make us happy, but because the thought of losing them makes us suffer. Both having them and not having them become sources of pain. This is all a bit ironic, because the truth is that we will lose everything. Every one of our partners, friends, family members, everything that brings us joy will one day leave our lives, either through life's normal uncertainty and change, or through the inevitability of death. So we have two choices. Embrace and love what we have and feel joy as deeply and fully as we can, and eventually lose everything. Or shield ourselves, be miserable, and eventually lose everything. Living in fear won't stop us from losing what we love. It will only stop us from enjoying it. What's the antidote to that fear? Gratitude. Welcome the people who care for you and the experiences you have together. Take joy in them. Be thankful for them. Eve has found a gratitude journal to be incredibly helpful. Making an active practice out of gratitude creates constant reminders of what you have in your life. Know that you are lucky to have people in your life with the power to break your heart, because it means you have love. The inevitability of change. We know our readers are approaching polyamory from a lot of different places. Some of you have never had a monogamous relationship. Others will be exploring polyamory after decades of monogamy. Some of you will be venturing into polyamory single, while others will be opening a previously monogamous partnership. Eve's experience fell into the latter category. Like many couples venturing into poly, she and Peter initially tried to change as little as possible, especially their existing relationship. And like many, they gravitated towards rules and structures to try and preserve the relationship as it had been, to create a feeling of security and stability. They agreed that the marriage was primary, and they had rules. Things like, we will never spend more time with another partner than with each other, and no one else is allowed to try and come between us. In fact, Eve's first online dating profile said, she shudders to recall, try to come between me and my primary, and you'll be out of my life faster than you can say polyamory. It's easy to understand why Eve and Peter wanted rules like these. Security, some basic predictability. These are fundamental human needs. At the same time, autonomy, independence, and self-reliance are also fundamental values for many people, including both of us. We've seen how a focus on these latter values alone can lead to some pretty poor treatment of partners. It's important to build relationships in such a way that people within them can feel secure, can feel a sense of belonging, and can have some basic expectations they can rely on. But it's also essential that people have agency in their relationships, that relationships be built on a foundation of choice and free will. These are not mutually exclusive goals. There's an uncomfortable truth, though. If you decide to do this, if you decide to open your heart and your life to loving more than one person, and letting your partners love others too, your life will change. You will change. If you started this journey with a partner, your partner will change. Every new person you let into your heart will disrupt your life. sometimes in small ways, sometimes in big ones. Disruption is a fact of life, and that's okay. After all, almost everything else you do in life risks disruption to your relationships. Taking a new job, losing a job. Couples counselors say that financial stress is more likely to ruin a marriage than any other single factor, including infidelity. Having a baby, moving to another city, getting sick or injured, having problems in your family of origin, taking up new hobbies, experiencing a death in the family. Hell, every time you walk outside your door or step into a car, you're risking serious injury or death, and that'll disrupt a relationship real quick. We don't live in fear of disruption when we're offered a new job or decide to have a child. We accept that these choices will change our lives. Ethical polyamory is similar. You accept that changes in your romantic life will affect your relationship. You resolve to act with integrity and honesty to cherish your partners to the best of your ability. And you trust that your partners will do the same for you. Many problems we encounter in polyamory, particularly when we're in a relationship that was previously monogamous, come from attempts to explore new relationships without having anything change. Sometimes those changes involve coming face to face with our deepest fears, abandonment, fear of loss, fear of being replaced, fear of no longer being special. Relationship change is scary. Sometimes it comes on as in jarring ways. Melissa's story. Melissa, a friend of Franklin's, loves sushi. She tried for months to get her husband Nico to try sushi with her, with no success whatsoever. He expressed in no uncertain terms that he was not interested in raw fish strapped to rice with electrical tape. Long after she gave up trying to take him to the sushi house, he started dating a new partner, Naveen, who also loved sushi. One day, Naveen suggested they go out for sushi, and this time he said, okay. Unsurprisingly, he discovered he loved it. Rather than think, hey, this is awesome, now I can finally share my love of sushi with him, Melissa was less than thrilled. It hurt her, too, as she said, to make a request of her partner, get a no, and then see him doing it with another. Melissa's story illustrates one of the hidden assumptions we often make about relationships. We can feel entitled to have our partners experience new things with us first, and become hurt if a partner chooses to experience these things with someone else. For a single person starting a relationship with someone who's partnered, this hidden expectation can plant landmines everywhere. Something as innocuous as an invitation to go out for sushi might trigger an unexpected blow-up. Embracing polyamory involves not only examining the expectation that our partners will never change, but also examining expectations about how and when they change. People don't always change in ways or on a timetable we want them to. New partners bring new experiences, and these experiences will change our relationships. Good relationships always change us. It's one of the best things about them. One of the standard tropes of monogamy is that we can prevent infidelity by limiting our partner's access to members of the opposite sex. Opportunity creates infidelity, or so we're told, so we limit opportunity. In polyamorous relationships, this trope can manifest in more subtle ways, such as by trying to limit the depth of a connection or the time a partner spends with another lover. As we discuss in Chapter 11, it's common for people in a relationship to seek to use the power they have to constrict, limit, or regulate a partner's other relationships in the hopes that this will make those other relationships less disruptive or threatening. People try all kinds of structures to do this, enforced power hierarchies, limitations on how much a partner is permitted to experience emotional or sexual intimacy with others, rules that an established couple will only have sex with a third person if both are there for it, often on the assumption that this will prevent jealousy, and so on. Of course, not everyone will have such feelings. If the idea of controlling your partner's other romantic connections to protect your relationship seems strange to you, you probably won't run into problems we describe in this chapter. An important skill in creating happy poly relationships involves learning to see other lovers, particularly a partner's other lovers, as people who make life better for both of you, rather than a hazard to be managed. If such a perspective does not come naturally to you, though, it can be learned. Doing so requires investing in communication, overcoming fear, and rejecting some of the pathological things we're taught about romance. It means accepting that you and your partners will grow and change, And the secret to maintaining relationships in the face of change is to be resilient and flexible. It also means cultivating a strong sense of security, accepting that we'll all make mistakes, building relationships robust enough to weather the mistakes, and making peace with change. Being alone. Humans are social animals. We function best when we're surrounded by people who care about us. The fear of being alone is part of being human. But if we're driven by that fear, if we're so afraid of being alone that we think losing a partner will destroy us, it's almost impossible to have a healthy relationship. It's okay to dislike being alone, but when we believe we can't be alone, things run off the rails. When that fear drives us, we can't easily set good boundaries or make reasoned choices. And if we don't feel like we're fully consented to a relationship, but instead are there because being alone is worse, then it's easy to feel like the relationship is something that's done to us rather than something that enriches our lives. From here, it's very easy to become resentful of our partners, especially when they do anything that reminds us of our fear of being alone. This fear and resentment can create a self-reinforcing cycle. When we're afraid of being alone, we get angry and resentful much more easily. This drives people away, which triggers the fear of being alone, which makes us angry and resentful. How do we break that cycle? By building relationships that move towards something rather than away from something. Relationships make us happier when we move toward intimacy with people who bring out the best in us rather than away from loneliness. In polyamory, it becomes especially vital to come to terms with the fear of being alone. First, because you are likely to be alone from time to time. And second, because more than one relationship is on the line. One of the core ingredients of a successful polyamorous relationship is the ability to treat all the folk involved, including not only our partners, but their partners as well, with compassion and empathy. It's almost impossible to be compassionate when all we feel is the fear of loss. Scarcity versus abundance. When they approach romantic relationships, people often fall into one of two patterns. Some follow a starvation model, and some follow an abundance model. In the starvation model, opportunities for love seem scarce. Potential partners are thin on the ground, and finding them is difficult. Because most people you meet expect monogamy, finding poly partners is particularly difficult. Every additional requirement you have narrows the pool still more. Since relationship opportunities are so rare, you'd better seize whatever opportunity comes by and hang on with both hands. After all, who knows when another chance will come along? The abundance model says that relationship opportunities are all around us. Sure, only a small percentage of the population might meet our criteria, but in a world of more than 7 billion people, opportunities abound. Even if we exclude everyone who isn't open to polyamory, and everyone of the wrong sex or orientation, and everyone who doesn't have whatever other traits we want, we're still left with tens of thousands of potential partners, which is surely enough to keep even the most ambitious person busy. The sneaky thing about both models is they're both right. The model we hold tends to become self-fulfilling. If we have a starvation model of relationships, we may tend to dwell on the times we've been rejected, which may lower our self-esteem, which decreases our confidence, and that makes it harder to find partners because confidence is sexy. We may start feeling desperate to find a relationship, which decreases our attractiveness further, so we end up with less success, which reinforces the idea that relationships are scarce. When we hold an abundance model of relationships, it's easier to just go and do the things that bring us joy, without worrying about searching for a partner. That tends to make us more attractive, because happy, confident people are desirable. If we're off doing the things that bring us joy, we meet other people there who are also doing the same. Cool. The ease with which we find potential partners, even when we aren't looking for them, reinforces the idea that opportunities for love are abundant, which makes it easier for us to go about doing what makes us happy, without worrying overmuch about finding a partner. And round it goes. We think our perceptions are shaped by reality, but the truth is, the reality we get is often shaped by our perceptions. These ideas will also influence how willing we are to stay in relationships that aren't working for us, both directly and indirectly. If we believe relationships are rare and difficult to find, we may not give up a relationship, even when it's damaging to us. Likewise, if we believe that relationships are hard to find, that may increase our fear of being alone, which can cause us to remain in relationships that aren't working for us. Naturally, there's a fly in the ointment. Sometimes the things we're looking for, or the way we look for them, create artificial scarcity. This might be because we're doing something that puts other people off, or because we're looking for something unrealistic. If you're looking for a Nobel Prize-winning Canadian supermodel with a net worth of $20 million, you might find potential partners few and far between. Similarly, if you give people the impression that you've created a slot for them to fit into and they won't be able to grow out of, opportunities for relationships might not be abundant either. Cognitive scientists talk about confirmation bias, the tendency to notice things that confirm our ideas, and to discount, discredit, or not notice things that don't. Facing discomfort. Flexibility promotes resilience. It helps create relationships that can adapt to the winds of change without breaking. It has a cost, though. Being flexible means being willing to face discomfort, because change is often uncomfortable. Accepting change, welcoming the idea that there might be many ways to have our needs met, letting go of the desire to hide from our fears by controlling the structures of our relationships, at some point, these will almost certainly bring us nose to claw with uncomfortable feelings. There is a trope in some circles, often applied to relationships. Don't do anything you're not comfortable with. When it concerns access to your body, your space, or your mind, it's good advice. We can always choose what we consent to. Often, though, it really means don't let your partner do anything you're not comfortable with. Or don't explore unknown situations if they make you uncomfortable. In such cases, we think don't do anything you're not comfortable with is terrible advice. There is more to life than avoiding discomfort. Sometimes discomfort is an inevitable part of learning and growth. Remember the first time you tried to ride a bike or swim or play a musical instrument? Remember how awkward and uncomfortable it felt? Having a brilliant life means going outside your comfort zone, and sometimes discomfort shows us ways we can improve. We would like to suggest the radical notion that being uncomfortable is not, by itself, a reason not to do something, nor to forbid someone else from doing something. There is more to life than going from cradle to grave by path of least discomfort. Furthermore, refusing to face discomfort can, if we're not careful, lead to unethical behavior. When avoidance of discomfort comes at the cost of placing controls on other people, we disempower those people. The status quo in almost any relationship is usually less scary than change, no matter how beneficial the change. When new people come into our lives, they bring new challenges and new delights. When relationships grow, they change. We can be tempted to try and maintain as much of the status quo as possible by limiting what the people around us can do. You may come into my life, but only this far. You may grow, but only to this level. In our experience, building walls around each other's freedom is more damaging in the long run than trusting in our partner's desire to do what's right by us, and trusting in ourselves to be able to adapt, find happiness, and feel cherished even when things change. Discomfort and change will find us sooner or later, no matter how much we try to hide from them. Meeting these things on our own terms, believing that we can be happy even in the face of change, all go a long way to building security and stability that endures. Living with integrity. Throughout this book, we position trust as an alternative to control in poly relationships. Fundamental to building trust is living with integrity. You build trust when you keep your promises, when you walk your talk. Trust decays when you break agreements, violate boundaries, and act in ways that are not in accordance with your professed values. Living with integrity can be the thing that holds you together when nothing else can. When you have no easy choices, and the effects of those choices on people you care about are impossible to predict, what serves as your guide? When you fail or make mistakes, are you able to look back and say, I upheld the values that are most important to me? Times can come in polyamorous relationships when there are no good choices, when you can't win, and no one else can either. Maybe it's just a question of where everyone is going to spend Christmas. Maybe it's where the kids go after a breakup. Maybe it's what you do when two partners whom you cherish with all your heart can't stand being in the same room together. We can talk about negotiation and compromise and finding win-win solutions, but sometimes the happy medium doesn't exist. The more people you put in the mix, the more likely conflicts are to arise. And sometimes there are no easy solutions. We've talked about the need for an ethical framework that maximizes the well-being of everyone involved. But sometimes you are stuck minimizing losses rather than maximizing gains. And no matter how you reason your way through a situation, it feels like crap to make choices that you know are going to hurt people. And sometimes you genuinely can't tell. Sometimes you're faced with choices that feel lousy in the short term and whose long-term effects can't be predicted. So when that happens, you can't make a move without hurting yourself or someone else. How do you make your choices? When we come to those places, that's when we try to center back on integrity. But even that can be slippery. What does it mean to act with integrity? Some people define integrity as essentially the same thing as honesty. Others see it as consistency of action or consistency of action with belief. But the root of the word integrity means whole. Focusing on integrity for us means intense examination of the present moment. What am I doing right now? And is it in alignment with my most authentic self? If I look back at myself in 10 years, would I like the person I see? Compassion. Before we talk about compassion, it's worth repeating the two axioms that underpin the ethics of this book. The people in the relationship are more important than the relationship. Don't treat people as things. Following an ethical system that relies on not treating people as things means, well, treating people as people. And that means practicing compassion. The word compassion is all over the place these days, but what does it mean? It's easy to throw it out as a glib admonishment, and ironically, it can sometimes include a shaming undertone, as in, I'm a compassionate person and you're not. Look how good I am because I am compassionate. If your social set intersects at all with New Age circles, you probably know someone who likes to play the more compassionate than thou Olympics. In fact, many of the ideas in this book can be used that way. Please, don't do that. Compassion is, again, not something you are, not something you feel, but something you practice. Compassion is putting ourselves in another's shoes. We can sit with a person in whatever they are feeling, bear witness to their pain while still loving who they are. Sometimes that person is ourselves. Compassion is not politeness. It isn't the same as kindness. It's not doing good deeds for someone while quietly judging them. Compassion engages your whole person, and it requires vulnerability, which is part of what makes it so hard. We have to be able to allow ourselves to be present as an equal with another person, recognize the darkness in them and accept it. And that forces us to embrace as well the darkness within ourselves. A lack of boundaries is not the same thing as compassion, nor is letting someone walk all over us, or overlooking poor behavior or mistreatment of others. Real compassion requires strong boundaries, because if we are letting someone take advantage of us, it becomes very hard to be authentically vulnerable to them. Compassion requires a willingness to hold other people accountable for things they do, while accepting them for who they are. How do we practice compassion? The cornerstone of compassion is simple, but emotionally difficult to achieve. It means, first and foremost, assuming good intent from others. In other words, looking for the most charitable interpretation of someone else's deepest motives. Until we all have magic mind-reading rubies in our foreheads, assuming another person's motives is always going to be dangerous. That's why we need compassion. When someone has done something we don't like, or that hurts us, or has failed to do what we want them to do, it's easy to assume the worst motivations from them. He doesn't care about my needs. She completely disregards my feelings. Compassion means coming from a place of understanding that others have needs of their own, which might be different than ours, and extending to them the same understanding, the same willingness to appreciate their own struggles, that we would want them to extend to us. We practice it every time we feel that surge of annoyance when someone does something we don't like, and then check ourselves and try to see the reason for their behavior from their perspective. We practice it every time we are gentle with others instead of being angry with them. and we practice it when we apply that same gentleness to ourselves, every time we accept that we are flawed and imperfect, but good despite that. We practice it in every recognition of each other's frailty and error. As polyamorous people, we face particularly pressing needs to cultivate compassion for our partners, their partners, and members of our community. But perhaps most important of all is compassion for ourselves. We are learning a new way of doing things. We're developing new skills that no one's taught us before, and challenging ourselves in ways that many people never do. We're trying to learn how to treat not just one partner well, but an entire network of people whose well-being depends on what we do. And that's hard. It's easy to beat yourself up for not being a perfect poly person, especially with the poly community putting its best face forward publicly in order to gain mainstream acceptance. Whether you're feeling jealous and insecure, or you're having trouble with anger management, or you can't figure out how to clearly communicate your needs, it's normal. You don't need to be a polyperfectionist. You're not the first person to have felt these things, not by a long shot. We've all been there. Try to treat yourself in the same way you would treat someone you cared about who's having the same problem, with compassion and acceptance. Check your expectations. The dictionary defines expectation as a belief centered on the future, a belief that something will or should happen in the future. That doesn't suggest the mischief our expectations can cause. Expectations lead to disappointment when they aren't met, and fear of that disappointment can cause us to hide our expectations, sometimes even from ourselves. Expectations differ from related feelings like hopes, fantasies, wishes, or desires. If you have the latter and they don't come true, you may feel disappointment or even grief, but we don't think that that means it's bad to have them. Expectations, on the other hand, can fuck with you. The difference is that an expectation implies a responsibility on the part of another person, or at least an entity like God or fate or the universe, perhaps even a sense of entitlement. So when it's not fulfilled, in addition to whatever disappointment you might otherwise feel, you also feel anger or blame. We all have expectations. Most of the time, our expectations are reasonable and normal. We expect that when we turn on the tap, water will come out. On a more basic level, we expect that the Lord